Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So today is May 5th, 2008, and I'm now with Dr. Osman Kobla. At the Center for Development and Security Analysis in Freetown, Sierra Leone. I'll let you introduce yourself further in the first part of the interview. But first, thank you for your time. And before we start the interview, I'd like you to confirm that you've given your consent.
Yeah, I have given my consent.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, I'd like to start by asking you about your personal background. Give us a brief overview, and particularly, how did you come about getting involved into security and police reform related issues?
Well, I'm Dr. Usman Gla, currently Dean of the Faculty of Social Sciences and Law for Abbey College, University of Sierra Leone, and also founder of the Center for Development and Security Analysis. I am a graduate. I have a BA, Political Science, a Master of Science in Economics, majoring in Political Science, and a PhD in Political Science. And my PhD thesis was about ECOWAS and West African security, looking beyond peacekeeping to see how conflict prevention could be a very vibrant strategy to prevent conflicts in Africa. And through my research, I've been doing work in the area of peace, security, and development, specific focus on West Africa. And my research interest basically is conflict resolution and post-conflict peace building, security sector reform, including regional security matters, and also civil society and governance in Africa. And I've done lots of work in that area. And as lecturer in the Department of Political Science, I've been teaching courses ranging from contemporary African political systems to politics of development and regional security. So with all this research interest and academic background, I have a very specific focus in the area of peace, security, and governance. And of course, in the area of security sector reform has been very close to my heart, especially as a researcher that has experienced the transition from authoritarian single party to multi-party democracy in Africa, in which the security sector is very key in determining these reforms in these areas.
Can you give us maybe, you mentioned this transition that took place in, is taking place in lots of countries in Africa, particularly West Africa. Can you give us your own description of maybe the transition, how it happened in Sierra Leone in terms of security sector reform and more specifically the police reform, and your assessment of where we stand now?
Well, as I rightly pointed out, you see, Sierra Leone has been in transition from war to peace and from authoritarian single party to multi-party democracy. So you have a double-edged transition, you know? A double-edged in the sense of transforming an authoritarian single party and military dictatorship into a multi-party system. You see, in 1978, the country was declared a one-party state. And within that configuration, there was very little in terms of transparency and governance of the security sector. And in fact, there was some amount of politicization of the security sector, including the police and the military. In the 1970s, for example, the head of the military and the police were the members of parliament. And in such a situation, it was very difficult to subject the security sector to firm control, civilian control in particular. And under military dictatorship, you know, in 1992, there was a military coup under the National Provisional Ruling Council, which went from 1992 to 1996. And then again, in 1997, May to February 1998, there was also a military interregnum. And you realize that within such a political system, it was difficult for democratic governance of the security sector, especially under the military rule. It was very difficult, for example, to subject the military or police budget to scrutiny in parliament, because parliament was non-functional at the time under that regime. And under one-party state, you see there was very little in terms of very coherent debates of issues, also that relating to security sector. So, and of course, even before the outbreak of the war in 1991, there was a lot to be done in the area of security sector, especially with the police. You know, for example, look at the recruitment. You had rules that determined recruitment, but they were patronized. Patronage was very high there. You know, there was the card system, the party card system, which determined the influx of people into the security sector, especially the police and the military. And this more or less mortgage professionalism, you know, because in most cases your loyalty was highly determinant in getting you recruited. And so that was how you got in the military and the police, people who do not have the requisite training and professional background to come into the military. And so when the war came in, the rebels we are faced with, sometimes an indisciplined and unprofessional military that was demoralized in terms of poor conditions, and so it was very easy for them. And you see, you realize there was the sobel issue where in military guys transformed themselves into rebels by night and becoming military men by day. So all things were getting bad. Ranks were usurped, you know, when the military took over. It was people were promoted just like that from one rank to another. And with the poor living conditions and poor conditions of service in the military and the police, there was then the need for some form of reform of our security sector.
Yeah. So in what context did the security sector reform, particularly the police reform, although the military reform was done in parallel in Sierra Leone, in what context did that happen?
Well, it, as I rightly pointed out, it was within the context of a post-war reconstruction and peace-building intervention that created an appropriate opportunity to overhaul the entire system itself. Because, you know, the security forces were also part of the problem in the war. And at the end of the war, there was need for them to be reformed. In fact, a complete overhaul of the entire situation, you know, because too many things were not good. And it started proper in 1996 because some people want to look at the reform from 1998 with the British intervention. But I realized when ECOMOC was here, they were, for example, requested to do a review of the ranks in the military. You know, and so that started. And interestingly, the SSR in this country is very interesting because it took place during a war situation. Because some people thought it would have been very difficult for a reform process to be put in place when there was war. But it went in tandem with war, and there was the restructuring program. Because you realize the war officially came to an end in January 2002. But the reform process started as far back as 1998. Very, very effective, you know. And with the police, for example. And one thing I realized in the police reform process, there was a change management system introduced. Top management level thinking, going into policy and all this sort of, before going down into the lower ranks. You know, for example, you have the CDIID, this complaint, discipline, and indiscipline. You know, and it was more or less Xerox under the community policing concept, wherein they believe there should be interface between civilians and the police for them to be very effective. And now you have the local policing boards all over the country. And these were more or less created because the concept of policing then shifted a little bit, wherein you have a high-handed police trying to take charge of situation. But now you have a situation where they think the police should work with the civilians, the community themselves, for them to be very effective. And that created some dividend because where that created confidence between the civilians and the police. And also the reform process has to take on board the deplorable conditions of service, because, you know, low salary, poor living conditions.
What's a to give an idea, where, how does the salary of a policeman right now, a constable, compare to the salary of a teacher or other professions?
It was poor. It was low, very, very low. You know, and these people were tasked with the responsibility of securing lives and maintaining internal security. That was dangerous.
When you said the reform that, at least the police reform that really started in 98, was very effective. It was the particularity of Sierra Leone is there was, at the highest level, there was the implant of a UK police commissioners. Is that part of the very effective reform?
Well,
which level, if you had to point to the few main elements of the...
Well, initially it was externally driven, and you can understand the situation at the time, because the country was just coming out of war, you know, and the funds were not there. And most of the force members were more or less have some problems professionally. So there was need at that point in time to have somebody at the top coming from the outside. But when time progressed in the reform process, top management also trained very high-level Sierra Leoneans. So the national ownership impetus later entered, because these people were trained to take over after the British would have left. And that was how, in fact, the current IG was spotted out during the process of the reform, that you have top people who can also take over, you know.
Currently, we'll get into some technical areas afterwards, but what would be your assessment of like the law and order and crime situation currently, maybe compared to a couple of years back?
Yeah. Well, as you can see, Sierra Leone, sometimes it beats the imagination of too many people. You know that as a post-war country, you will have seen a situation of high crime rates, you know, but I think there has been lots of sensitization and lots of training within the police force to handle crime, you know. But what I think is most highly required is modern techniques to handle crime, you know, because, you know, the people are just coming from war. Most of them will be scared with a very high presence of police, this gun, you know. And for example, when you want to disperse strike demonstrators, do we have cannon water tanks to do that? Mm. You know, we need this sort of crowd management.
For crowd management,
yes,
riot control.
Yeah. Mm. And you see also a situation where you have lots of sensitization on security issues. You see, in the past, there used to be too much secrecy about security matters, you know. But now you have, for example, the DISECs, the district security committees. You have the provincial security committees in which the civilians are sitting with the police, the security forces, to discuss issues pertaining to security. And then you also have this local needs policing, you know. The local needs policing is also creating some effectiveness, because you're now creating a situation where the locals themselves think it is their own business to ensure that their security, because security is for them. Because you see, there is this shift of emphasis now from physical security of the state to that of human security, you know, which also has some relevance in our situation. Because now we are not only worried about the state security apparatus, but we're also worried about the security of the human being himself. Human rights violations, guaranteeing the rights of the citizens. And in with the educational programs being introduced, human rights education, for example, within the police force, that is also sensitizing members of the police force that they have to be very, very sensitive to the rights and dignity of the people. And this is also creating some confidence, you know, because with that type of training, the police, I'm sure, will know how to handle people, you know.
Are there other training programs, aside from human rights training, that caught your attention or that you've somewhat been involved in?
Yeah, many, because you see, this human rights training have been carried on in many angles. For example, you know, there have been training for local authorities, there have been training for the police, there have been training even for civil society groups working in the area of security sector. In fact, our center is trying to do that, because we believe, for example, we are saying there is need for even a training program for journalists on how to report issues of security sector reform. Because there is, for example, quite a good number of people do reporting on security, but they don't even know about the basic national security architecture and the reform process itself. Mm-hmm. You know, so we need this type of training to encourage people to know how, where are we now?
Can you describe some of the training that the Center for Development and Security Analysis has done?
Yes, for example, we had a project with the Center for Torture Victims in Denmark. We did a study on the TRC in this country. Mm-hmm. And we recruited about
Truth and Reconciliation.
Yes, we recruited about 8 national researchers, young researchers. Mm-hmm. And we brought them here. We gave them training in methodology, how to go into communities, how to also appeal to them. And we also participated in the security sector review document. We prepared it for ONS, the Office of National Security. We did a booklet on the SSR. And that booklet has lots of information. And we proposed to the Office of National Security that we do training at the local level on this SSR review booklet, so that these people can also take it on board. They can understand what the review process has been about.
Are there some aspects of training that are lacking, you think?
Well, yes, because what we believe is most civil society groups that are working on security sector issues, security sector, do have very thorough understanding about the national security architecture and the security sector reform. And if these people are going to engage in these issues, they need the training.
How have you, the training that you've actually conducted, how do you evaluate the impact of this kind of like sensitivation lecturing, and have you seen any changes over the year?
Yeah, well, for example, working with local communities, we're now beginning to see a receptive perception of local communities about the police. You know, immediately after the war, people don't want to see security people because they think these are the corrupt, these are the people that were responsible. But after getting interaction, because we also do what we call peace, security, and development roundtables here. And normally we bring together members of the security forces, practitioners, and government officials, civil society together, to engage, to deliberate on issues of security. For example, the latest of our roundtables was on the role of women in peace, security, and governance. And this frank discussion fora have created some confidence among these men.
You seem to be very keen on the issues of accountability of the security sector, particularly of the police, because you're also a member of the civil society and you work with them. You mentioned the importance of, for instance, the creation of an institution like the CDIID, where complaints can be brought to the attention of the police about other police. Can you describe for us the different mechanisms for the community to be able to access the police for this kind of thing, and how effective are they in practice?
Yeah, I've told you, we now have the local policing boards nationwide, you know. And in fact, normally these local policing boards, they call them local police partnership boards. Normally the locals are in charge. And the police are there, and they get series of information, series of discussion about the needs of their local needs policing. And through this mechanism also, the civilians can also know what is going on in their security.
So the police briefs the community as well?
Yes.
How often do these happen?
Well, I think it's a monthly.
Monthly?
Yes.
And it's in the big cities as well as in the
smaller areas. Because you have the DISECs, you have the PROSEC members also part of this local policy partnership board.
And since when do these exist?
Well, I think 2 years back, I'm sure they were introduced.
And the participation is still as active?
Yes, because a month ago we were in Kenema, where we conducted a workshop, a review of one of the projects we are doing. And we have members of this local needs policing boards coming to that meeting, and they spoke highly of how these boards have been very instrumental in ensuring security. Because one thing that is coming out in this country clearly is that people no longer joke with the security because of the lessons of the war, you know, and they don't want to take security lightly, and so they see it as a very serious business. You know, they don't just leave it in the hands of the security forces.
Are they complaints? The CDIID is based within the police. It's part of the police, the Sierra Leone police. Do people actually go to the police to complain about other behavior of other policemen, for instance?
Yeah, they do. And for the mere fact that there is now that mechanism in existence, I think it's also driving the message to the police that you no longer just go scot-free when you abuse your office. You know, I think it's because some people even say, I will take you to the CIDID, I will go to the complaint section, and that will scare away the police. Mm-hmm. You know, I only hope they will implement what the complaints they receive, they translate them into actions to ensure that these impunities committed by policemen are buried or are nipped in the bud.
Has there been cases where the complaints brought to the CIDID resulted in action, for instance?
Well, I haven't done much research in that area, okay. So I don't think I would go into that.
And in terms of public perceptions in general, are they some of the police? Or has there been some study done? And what are the the indicators of change in that regard?
Yeah, well, I think so, because, for example, 6 months back, we did a security perception survey here with the Bond Center for International, the Institute for International Affairs in Germany.
In Bonn, yeah.
In Hamburg.
In Hamburg.
The Institute for International Affairs, African Affairs. Yes, and people generally, the results, the analysis of our perception show that increasingly, people are getting a very positive image about the police and the security situation in the country.
And what are the major shortcomings, maybe, that the population points to?
Yeah, well, some people are still saying the conditions of service for the police are still not that as high, and they still need some support. And if you want to tackle corruption, for example, you really need to improve on the conditions of the police. And also people express fear about still the delays in court prosecution. You know?
What form does corruption take typically? What are we talking when you talk about corruption, what does it mean concretely?
Traffic in courts, you know.
So traffic police reliving you mentioned one of the major one of the major stake of security sector reform was also the depoliticization of the security sector, mm-hmm. Because of the previous history, mm-hmm. of it. Where are we in the depoliticization of the?
Well, if you look at the new recruitment codes, it's emphasizing, for example, you make sure you have a balanced force drawn from each. You make sure you don't allow ethnicity or regionalism to enter into the calculation. And you make sure you set up professional standards and academic qualification. And there is also the requirement that sometimes your community will also identify you because you don't want to get criminals into the forces.
How do you get inputs from the community regarding the background of the
people?
Well,
they go through the department chiefs to get the characters of people. Uh-huh. You know, the chiefs.
So the Sierra Leone police reflects the ethnic balance of the of Sierra Leone? There's like in the charter?
Well, I think you put in place transparent mechanisms of recruitment. And this will not particularly appeal to any ethnic or religion,
based on qualifications. So there's no ethnic quotas or anything. Yeah. Okay. So it's professional standards. In terms of the current police, there's been recently a change in the president. Since late 2007. Mm-hmm. Has this created any changes in top management of the police, or has the Sierra Leone police successfully passed the test of a change in government?
Well, in the first place, they played a very crucial role in maintaining security during the elections. They were highly commended, did a very professional job. I think in the post-election environment, they are also exhibiting their professionalism. And I'm sure with more training and more conditions of service, we'll do better.
Are there some obstacles to
the reform?
Yeah, to the reform of the police?
Yes, of course. You see, it has to do with the sustainability of the reform process. you know, because you see most of the funds are being coming from the outside. And in the absence of these funds, how do we get to continue this? And the second thing is you also have people who resist change from within, who think change will affect their soft zones. You know, so sometimes you also have internal constraints to the reform process, especially those who think they will not benefit from the change process itself. So these are some of the obstacles. And the others are basically also, it has to do with the conditions of service. You know? In the absence of funds, it will also be difficult to improve.
So this is the second part of the interview with Dr. Osman Bla. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about some of the obstacles to the reform process. Mm-hmm. Now I'd like to ask you maybe what are some of the broader challenges in general? You mentioned that you participated in the National Security Review and produced booklets in SSR. Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask you if there are some tasks that need to be prioritized over others when looking at security sector reform.
Well, in fact, I've been saying this in most of my interviews. You see, in terms of improving the security forces themselves, in terms of their combat readiness, I think a lot has been done. But in the area of civilian oversight and accountability of the forces, we need a lot to be done in that area. You know, that is security sector governance. You know, for example, you have the presidential, the Committee on Defense and Presidential Security of Parliament, do they have the capacity to provide oversight over the security forces? You know, this issue of security sector governance needs very serious attention. That is, how do we get civil society, for example, to ensure the security forces to be accountable and transparent? How do we get Parliament to ensure that funds given to the security forces are being used judiciously? You know, how do we get them to account? That aspect is a challenge, you know, and also in the area of security sector reform in this part of the world, you also have to look at the regional realities, you know, because the forces are crisscrossing, you know. The Mano River Union sub-region, you have ECOMOC forces, we are here to change the situation. You have also an international peacekeeping force coming here. So you are not only preparing the security forces to respond to national realities, but to also the sub-regional realities. So do we have that being done seriously? You know, you have many border crossing points, for example. You have the small arms proliferation. You have the movement of armed groups, you know. You know, the reintegration process. Maybe the 2Ds went on very well, the disarmament and the demobilization. But the reintegration of these former ex-combatants, they didn't go too well because of lack of funds. And some of them are now in Guinea, Cote d'Ivoire, and they will be a security threat. So how do we prepare our security forces to take charge of this situation when these issues do emerge? It could also be a challenge. And also, you know, we have with the SSR, we have the MACP, the Military Aid to Civil Power, wherein the police have been given the bulk of the task to take care of internal security and to only interface with the military under a very serious crisis and arrangement. Mm. But now, with that situation, you also have to give more funds to the police, you know, because they have a lot to do. Yeah. And, of course, you know, as a post-war country, you have a youthful population with very unemployment also very high. So this situation also creates room for insecurity. So how do you also get the security forces to respond to these realities?
In terms of the police needs more fund, is it for the existing to reinforce and better equip the existing police that would be of 9,500 approximately, or is it also to increase the number possibly of the police force?
No, not to increase. Because not to increase really, but to improve upon their conditions. The barracks, the uniforms, the equipment, you know.
Where do police officers live currently? If there are no
they
barracks.
They have quarters, but sometimes they don't have enough quarters. You know, and even some of the quarters, they need to be rehabilitated.
All police officers live within
police
quarters.
They are supposed to be living barracks, yes.
But within the communities,
yes,
at the same time, they are not like the military in barracks outside of the cities. Okay. What kind of allies in the country, or I mean, in Sierra Leone, are essential for the success or of the reform?
What is allies. Required? The alliance.
Well, allies, like who should be on board for a successful reform?
The international community to provide the funds. Mm-hmm. That's the many actors from the outside. And you also have the civil society, the communities themselves, and the police themselves, the high ranking and the lower ranks as well.
When you mentioned the importance of parliament and civil society oversight, there's been a number of initiatives for some kind of civil society oversight. What are some concrete suggestions, maybe, that you'd have to make in terms of improving this oversight? What would make a
First place, training. You need to train these committees. For example, the defense, presidential security and defense committee. You need really to understand the security architecture itself. And also the reform process itself. Mm. You know, with this knowledge, they could also be able to do something. And the other thing we've just concluded, I hope Thomas J. told you about it, we did a capacity needs assessment of the Presidential Defense Committee. We also realized that the committee itself is constrained in many ways. You know, they don't have adequate clerks to help them do the documentation of their work. They don't have a library. They don't have computers, and they don't even have office space. You know, we are in the seat and do their job effectively, you know. So all this, and for civil society also, they also need the training. You know, because many civil society groups don't think they have anything to do with security because they are afraid. But now we are telling them, no, you have to venture out because it's the taxpayers' money that they are spending on the security forces. So you have to get a voice in how these people carry themselves along.
In terms of achievements, are there some particular experiments or innovations that you think merit particular attention in the course of the police reform, some aspects that have been really successful?
Yeah, of course. The top management, policy level, you know. You see, when you have a strategic management system now, wherein the top people do lots of thinking, critical reflections, on how they carry about policing. That creates sanity in the police force. That creates foresight. That creates informed decisions and policy making. Because now you have, of course, you will have spoken to the police themselves, their management boards, the different AIGs. They have collapsed most of the ranks, you know.
So that's for the internal management.
Yeah.
Or to the police. Or in the other aspects of police reform, maybe building community policing and so on.
Yes, the police success? Partnership boards, for example, very innovative, mm-hmm. and very, very laudable, because they have created avenues for very frequent interaction between the police and the local people to ensure confidence, to ensure security, to work as a team. You know, in promoting security.
As you mentioned earlier, police reform, especially when it has inputs from the outside, will always cost a considerable amount of money. Are there any programs in particular that were maybe not that expensive, but that yielded very good benefits?
Those that are from within?
Either within or from the international or sponsored by international community?
Well, just as I've told you, for example, the creation of this awareness building and sensitization programs, you know, on the security sector reform itself, and the creation of fora, you know, for interaction between and among the security forces, the practitioners, the decision makers, and civil society is also paying dividends, you know. Mm-hmm.
So now maybe one last question. In terms of, so the donors have been very involved through the whole process, but particularly British, the UN when there was a peacekeeping mission here. Has this donor support been sustained? And are there any suggestions that you had made in terms of the relation between the donor and the and the country that could be improved, or some policy changes and management changes that could
well,
be
what I've also been saying in the area of donor support, in the first place, it's coordination. You have many donors doing many things in the area of SSR, but do they coordinate among themselves well to avoid duplication? You know, and another area is also for these donors to work against the background of the realities of the nation, you know, that is taking into consideration the social, economic, and cultural realities, you see. And I think there has been some success in that area, because I think there are now the fora created or mechanism for the interaction between the donors and the government itself and the people, you know, for them to look at how the process should be. And the other area, again, is the sustained support of programs, you see. Because to me, it will not be helpful if you support a security sector intervention and you don't see it consolidated and you leave. It means all your gains will ripple off, you know. So there should be a sustained, should be sustained international support process.
Are there any a specific point that we haven't discussed that you'd like to make in terms of maybe the way forward?
Or? Well, I think I'm okay.
Okay. Well, Dr. Osman Blah, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.